Well, thank you, Mr. Turnblad. It's very nice to be here. This is one of these kind of days you wish you could take a snapshot of it and save it. I think this is, who was it, Debbie, were you saying this is like one of the 3 days of the year that we Minnesotans kind of live for, days like this? We get three of them, and today's one of them, so enjoy it. It is very nice to be here, and hello to everyone also who's joining us online. I'm glad to have you with us as well. So I think to start this message, I want to share with you a recent article that was published on May 3rd of this year in the Lake Region Echo. That's our local newspaper in Alexandria. The article is as follows. There has never been a society which has revered the young for their wisdom or insight. Not one ever. Adhering to this concept, the U.S. Constitution has minimum age requirements for many elected officials. Our life expectancy now is about double what it was back in 1776. With this, I propose a change. But it's not with the minimum age of serving in Congress, being president, or the age of any elected state official. Any one of us could look back at our 10 years ago self and identify a person less capable of making wise decisions. Would any 20-something conclude that their teenage years were the height of their understanding? Of course not. And if one could look ahead 10 years, who would not conclude that waiting for us is a person more capable than now? There are many factors that lead to wisdom and understanding, but life experiences are the primary foundation of both. No people or culture would dispute this. No people or culture would choose the young to lead them. Having a minimum age requirement for high-level serving in a democracy or a republic is logical. There can exist exceptionally wise young people and, inversely, incapable aged people. So whatever system we design for government will not be perfect. We are humans, incapable of perfection after all. It may be debatable what a minimum age of wisdom should be, but short of having a wisdom barometer available to us, age is a reasonable measuring rod. I do not find the minimum age requirement of elected officials to be important, however. If a society deems an individual capable of holding an office and this individual is young, so be it. I place the importance on the individuals who elect the officials. Society should see to it that this duty is done responsibly. Raise the voting age to 60. I see the reverse approach coming, however. To many, acquiring a driver's license seems to be an acceptable qualification for voting. Eventually, preteens handling the task of mowing the lawn will measure up and have an equal voice in electing officials. But I'm advocating for the opposite. Set the minimum age to vote at 60. As I'm 58 when writing this, note that I'm campaigning for a requirement that disqualifies me. Clearly, increasing the minimum voting age to 60 would upset many people. Two specific groups in particular. Certainly the young would be offended. But also those who depend upon the young for whatever political advantage the young voter provides. Wisdom is not on their side, however. I pledge no allegiance to any political party and find sprinklings of both truth and absurdity with any and all parties. I'm simply pointing out that wisdom is with the aged, and the aged among us should therefore be given the sole responsibility for choosing leadership. Ask a teenager if they are smart. You know the answer you will receive. But research the Dunning-Kruger effect, and you'll place your chips on our seniors. I seek wisdom in our leaders. Young voters do not meet the prerequisite for selecting qualified leadership, and it's not their fault. They just haven't lived long enough to qualify themselves for such a responsibility. Raise the minimum voting age to 60 years old. That would not align with the particular desires of young people or with those who rest their politics on such demographics. Let the arguments against this ensue, but any such opposition is in direct conflict with having the wisest among us choose the leadership roles in this country. Okay, this was the opinion piece published. And while I wrote this article, I wasn't completely satisfied with the published version. I had to cut it drastically to fit to kind of the editorial guidelines for how long an opinion piece could be for this newspaper. I mean, this was pretty tough, as there were many additional supporting points to my opinion that had to be painfully omitted. I referenced the Dunning-Kruger effect in this article, and I did expand on this human flaw in a previous message. This is simply the tendency that we all have to think of ourselves as being an expert in a particular topic when actually we know very little about it. We can read a single article about climate change, for example, and then confidently become an expert in this arena. I mean, we can all exhibit this tendency, but the young are more susceptible to it. I had a career as a software engineer, and I have a degree in mathematics, so I mean, my perspectives and opinions are going to be based in logic. Whether one would agree or disagree with my proposal to raise the voting age, I have the foundation of my position resting on logic. It is simply logical for the wisest among a population to select leadership in a democracy or a republic. But there's an underlying problem with our form of government. Our founding fathers created a republic which is different than a true democracy. A democracy can be overrun by mob rule. Our early leaders actually expressed this as a grave concern. So a republic instead was established, which they believed would be more stable. And along this line, minimum age requirements for serving in leadership do help a republic from large pendulum swings to the right or to the left. But our form of government involves humans in selecting leaders and humans who lead. Humans are the problem. So while submitting an article to a local newspaper about what I think could be done to, improve our government, I'm simply polishing the brass on the Titanic. Or, maybe you prefer the phrase putting lipstick on a pig. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus tells us not to cast our pearls before swine, which is along the same lines as all of these other metaphors. There are just some tasks that are sort of useless to do. So rather than writing an article, my time may have been better spent, helping my neighbor till his garden. But, of course, I am human, and I have a hard time sometimes keeping my trap shut. Israel was in Egypt during the reign of the pharaohs. To become a pharaoh, you were a son of a previous pharaoh. Now, I researched how all of this started, this idea of royal succession, but I couldn't find a compelling explanation based on historical evidence or documentation. Maybe you know more about this than I was able to uncover. I couldn't find a starting point to this tradition. Amenhotep was one of these pharaohs who ruled Egypt around 1500 BCE. He became pharaoh when his father Amos died. But Amenhotep did not have a surviving heir, so he was succeeded by one of his generals, Thutmose. There was no longer a continuous royal bloodline, as Thutmose was no relation to Amenhotep. So this idea of a royal bloodline does fail. And the reign of the pharaohs ended when Cleopatra's son died when he was 17 years old. When Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was divided up between four of his generals, none of whom were related to him. The Romanovs, who had ruled Russia for 300 years, were executed after a revolt. Their bloodline ended. The Spanish Habsburg dynasty ended around the year 1700 after 16 generations of inbreeding caused immense health and fertility issues. Leadership for Israel after they left Egypt was not originally hereditary. It started with Moses, right? Then came Joshua, and then later the period of the judges. God selected Moses to be a leader, and we can reference Numbers 27:18 to see that God then picked Joshua. And throughout the time of the judges, God had his hand in selecting leaders of Israel who would follow his ways, who would do his will. Then Israel wanted a king. While God was disappointed in this form of government that Israel chose, he did oblige them, and he selected Saul to be the first king of Israel. Up to and including Saul, the leadership of Israel could be considered to be logical choices. The men and women who led Israel either had biblical wisdom or military expertise, and I would imagine both most of the time. We at this time would not have had a vote in who would be the leader, but, you know, we probably would not have raised a stink with whomever God selected. And then came David. God directed Samuel to go see Jesse, where God said that one of Jesse's sons would be the next king. Well, as we know, Jesse had eight sons, and Samuel looked at the older seven of these men, and it seemed logical to him that the leader would be among them. You know, a tall and strong man, you know, like Saul was. But we know David was chosen by God, which is to my point. David would not have been the choice Samuel would have made, as it didn't seem logical. So let's say we were back there then at this time in a democracy, and we, the people of Israel, were choosing our succession to King Saul. Well, Job 12:12 tells us that wisdom is with the aged and with length of days understanding. Well, this is one reason why I proposed in my newspaper article that seniors should be the only ones voting. Would our seniors, the wisest among us, have selected David as king? I doubt it. Sure, David did a good job protecting sheep, but how would that logically translate into effective leadership? That'd be our position. Someone older than David, perhaps a tall and strong man, would have been chosen. Join me in Ezekiel 34, and let's read verses 23 through 24. Ezekiel chapter 34, and let's read verses 23 through 24. Ezekiel 34, and starting in verse 23, the Bible reads, "I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God. And my servant David, a prince among them, I, the Lord, have spoken." God here is telling us that David will have a leadership role in his kingdom. And this isn't the only place in Ezekiel where this is noted. In other words, David was the right choice to succeed Saul. If we were a democracy back during the time of King Saul, we would have made a mistake back then in not picking David. God knew the right choice for leadership. We wouldn't have known this. But it's not our fault. As young people do not have the life experiences which lead to wisdom, older people, you know, infused with wisdom and using logic, are still human. We can't look at the heart. We can't foresee what could transpire. In other words, regardless of how much wisdom we may have, we are still nothing but children, literally, of God. We need to understand this position we have of not being all that smart in comparison to God, even the aged among us. Join me in 1 Peter 5. We'll read verses 1 through 4. If you'd like to join me in 1 Peter chapter 5, and we'll read verses 1 through 4. First Peter chapter 5, and starting in verse 1, the Bible reads, "The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion but willingly, not for dishonest gain but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away." The seniors among us here are given instructions. Shepherd the flock of God. Care for others, in other words. David, a future shepherd, as we're told in Ezekiel, will have this responsibility as well. And we'll all be cared for by the chief shepherd, Jesus Christ, as we read here. The elders among us are given this responsibility to shepherd. The young among us are not. My idea of requiring someone to be 60 to vote can make a young person feel insignificant. And we can find many verses in the Bible that tell us the young should submit to the aged. I mean, just go ahead and look at verse 5 here in 1 Peter chapter 5, for example. A young person can feel suppressed and marginalized. Regardless of our age, we are all on our own ship, and we want to have our hand on the rudder. It's what's called being human. God picked David to be the king of Israel after Saul. I don't think we would have in a democracy or republic, even the wisest among us. Now let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 7, and let's read verses 12 through 16. 2 Samuel chapter 7. And we'll read verses 12 through 16. Second Samuel chapter 7, starting in verse 12, the Bible reads, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the thrones of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. And your throne shall be established forever." All right, the prophet Nathan here is speaking to David. This prophecy is reiterated in what we read earlier in Ezekiel, where David will be a shepherd in God's kingdom. And I note here that God puts together being a king with being a shepherd. A king here in 2 Samuel in what we read, and a shepherd in what we read in Ezekiel. Now, one definition of a shepherd is one who tends sheep, right? That's a simple definition. And to tend is to take care of. But there's another more fitting definition of a shepherd when it comes to this label given to David and to Jesus Christ. This definition of a shepherd is one who tends and rears sheep. To rear sheep means to also ensure the generations will continue. It's not just about caring for and protecting the sheep in a flock. It's also about the future proliferation of their offspring. It was the future that God could see with David. It wasn't just about tending. Now, the title that I have for this message is Tend and Rear. Both are important to a flock, and each is distinctive from the other. Tend is about the now. Rear is about the future. My dad always tells me this story. He began working for a road construction company in 1958. As he tells it, his dad, my grandfather, had to fill in and start the job for my dad because my dad still had a week of high school left. The job was starting, and it wasn't going to wait for my dad to finish school, so my grandpa filled the position for a week until my dad could step in. I kind of like these types of stories from prior generations. Stories like this don't seem that common anymore these days. Well, after a couple of years, my dad's company started a project down here in the Twin Cities metro area. And to work construction in this part of Minnesota, well, you had to be unionized. Well, my dad, you know, all of his peers and coworkers, well, they were just angry. They were livid. Why would they want to take part of their salary and pay union dues? I kind of think the practice of jumping ship and finding another job is perhaps more common now than it was back then. I think you just kind of stuck it out more back then. So they gave in and they joined the local 49ers union. Well, he was a union member for 40 years and retired at 62. Well, with that pension and the medical benefits associated with the union, he's now comfortable. I mean, he's not rich, but he's comfortable. And he talks often about how joining the union was the best decision he made in his career, even though back then he was so adamantly against the idea. Now, the advantage wasn't about paying the union dues back then and, you know, maybe the lack of freedom you had and being an individual. It wasn't about the now back then. It was about the future. We can read in the Bible about the separation of Israel from Judah after Solomon died. God did not want this. It was the decision of men. You know, God's plan was for the lineage of David to be on the throne over all of Israel. But Jeroboam took the bulk of Israel away from God's plan. Now, Jeroboam, he was no doubt a strong, compelling leader, appealing to those who chose to follow him. And the people at this time no doubt looked at him like Samuel looked at the older sons of Jesse. But the people then didn't know the future. People did not have the ability to look at the heart. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 10 and verse 8. Let's read a bit about Rehoboam, Solomon's son. 2 Chronicles 10 and verse 8. Second Chronicles 10 and verse 8. But he rejected the advice the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. All right, simple verse here. Here, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, made a mistake. He was given advice from elders and advice from, what we're told, young men. And I don't think it was really young men here that he listened to. I mean, we read here that these men were men he grew up with. Well, the implication is that these men were about the same age as Rehoboam. We see here he rejected the advice given to him by the elders. And this led to Jeroboam's revolt. It's more biblical support for my newspaper article, Seek the Wisdom of the Aged. Now, the list of good kings of Israel and Judah in the Bible, it's a pretty short list. If you were to name these kings, they would include David, Solomon, Asa, Hezekiah, Josiah, and Jehoshaphat. Now, it's worth noting that all of these kings were of the line of David. The Bible does not mention a single overall good king that followed in the line of Jeroboam. Around 721 BCE, Assyria swept in from the north and captured the northern kingdom of Israel. The 10 tribes, which originated from Jeroboam's leadership, were taken into captivity. And with this, we've come to refer to these people as the lost 10 tribes of Israel, as historical records do not positively identify these people anymore. I mean, there's speculation and there's some reasonable conclusions to be made and where these tribes ended up. But starting with Jeroboam, the future of these people was quite cloudy. A little more than a century later, the kingdom of Judah was then taken into captivity in Babylon. But this captivity only lasted 70 years. Cyrus the Great, the ruler of Babylon, allowed the people to return to Jerusalem. The historical record of these people, descendants of David, were not lost. As we read in 2 Samuel, David's house would endure. And we can see from these two fractions of Israel as a whole, you know, Israel and Judah, that those who did not follow God fell first. And most were lost to history. But God was with the lineage of those who did not rebel against him. David's house did eventually fall into captivity, but the future of this house will stand strong. God sees the heart. God knows the future. While the aged among us hold more wisdom, we are all like children in our complete understanding, with God being our all-knowing Father. Logic may have pointed us toward one of Jesse's older sons to be the leader of Israel. Logic and reason may have pointed us away from Rehoboam and guided us to follow Jeroboam in his revolution. If it were a democracy, we'd probably all have voted in what would turn out to be a vote against God. Jeroboam appealed to the now back then for the 10 tribes that split away from the line of David. He was a shepherd of sorts, a leader who in his mind was tending to his flock, the people who followed him. But he did not rear this flock. Now, we can read about how he created his own holy days and his own holy times, and how in the end he did not repent, which was his greatest, truest and greatest sin. God was not in the future of this flock. Christ sacrificed himself for us. Was that event about that specific point in time? No. It wasn't. It was about our future. Look at it this way. Christ purchased an annuity for us with his death. And we can redeem the rewards for this investment that he put in our name. Jesus left us an inheritance, and the compound interest in this is growing to astronomical levels. Christ's sacrifice, it wasn't about the now back then. It was about the future. Now, Christ was a shepherd that was focused on tending to his flock, his followers. But he was equally as much focused on rearing his flock, preparing his followers for the future. And that includes us. There's a small egg that's laid on a leafy plant. After a week or so, a tiny larva emerges from the egg. Now, the first meal of this larva is the eggshell itself, and then it simply becomes an eating machine. In about a month, the larva will increase its body mass 1,000 times over. Now, during this time period, the larva will molt several times as it outgrows its exoskeleton. And each time it does this, its appearance changes, sometimes dramatically. It's a dangerous time for this stage in this animal's life. It's subject to weather conditions, to disease, to parasites, predators. You know, of the hundreds of similar eggs that were laid, there may be only a few that survive. At some point, the larva stops eating. It will then hang itself upside down from a twig or a small branch, and it will spin itself a silky cocoon. Now, this shell hardens, protecting what is inside. And during the next week or two, a dramatic evolution occurs inside this chrysalis. The larva, the caterpillar, transforms into a butterfly. It's one of the truly amazing life cycles that God created in nature. Now, during that larva stage, the caterpillar doesn't really know what's in store for its future. It just knows to eat and keep eating. It doesn't know it will someday become a beautiful butterfly and an effective pollinator of plants and flowers. It doesn't know its purpose. It just lives in the now. And we are somewhat like that caterpillar now in our lives. I mean, we work, we eat. We have to live life in the now. We have to tend to our own lives now and the lives of those around us. But God did give us understanding. He gave us wisdom. God has shared with us what our purpose is. One day we will transform into a new creation. Our life now is for that future. We must focus on rearing our own lives and the lives of those around us. So we must both tend to our lives and rear our lives. Don't be the shepherd of your own life by just tending to it. Rear your life. Now, we referenced Ezekiel chapter 34 earlier, where David was identified to be a future shepherd in God's kingdom. Now let's go to Ezekiel 37. And let's read verses 24 through 25. Let's read about David again in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 37, we'll read verses 24 through 25. Ezekiel chapter 37, and starting in verse 24, the Bible reads, "David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in my judgments, and observe my statutes, and do them. Then they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever, and my servant David shall be their prince forever." Well, here again, David is identified as a future shepherd and a prince of God's people. This is in the dry bones chapter of Ezekiel, what we understand to be the time of the second resurrection. A shepherd is one who tends sheep, yes. A shepherd feeds sheep, protects sheep, nurtures them, yes. But the important aspect of a shepherd is one who rears sheep. Rearing sheep is the focus on the flock enduring into the future. Ezekiel here tells us that God's children will dwell in his land forever. Would we have chosen David back then to be the king after Saul if we had a vote? I doubt it. Even the wise among us would have chosen one of the older sons of Jesse. We don't know the future. We can't see the heart. The problem with a democracy or a republic is that it relies on humans. Wisdom is with the aged, which is why I proposed raising the voting age to 60. Even my suggestion is more about tending to the now, however, fixing a problem that I see in the now. But as they say, you can't make a silk purse from a sow's ear. And I don't really say that, but I guess that was a common expression back in the 16th century. We do not have electoral processes or government rule in general to my liking. And you may feel the same way, even if you disagree with my proposal to raise the voting age to 60. And you may submit your own article to a newspaper on how to correct a problem that you see with America. But I'm not too worried about it. And I don't think you need to be worried about it either. God did not want Israel to have a king, but he obliged the people. And he gave Saul the first opportunity. Now, while Saul may have had the tending characteristics of a shepherd, he did not have the rearing quality. God saw both of these attributes in David. And David's bloodline will continue through the age to come when he will be restored as a prince and a shepherd of God's people. But we read earlier in 1 Peter chapter 5 that there is a chief shepherd. David will be under Jesus Christ, who will have the ultimate authority in God's kingdom. And this is because Jesus has the ultimate qualities of a shepherd. He will know best how to tend his flock, yes. He will protect and care for the sheep under his watch. But Christ knows how best to rear his flock. He has the wisdom that comes with age because, well, he's been around for a long time. But more importantly, he and the Father are one. He knows what is best for our future, and his knowledge will be that hand on the rudder of the ship of our lives. And his flock will live throughout eternity in a life beyond our imagination. Even the wisest among us cannot grasp this incredible glory. Let's close here in Revelation 7 and verse 17. Revelation chapter 7 and verse 17. Revelation chapter 7 and verse 17. The Bible reads, "For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." Kind of hard for me to imagine a life without tears and hardships, but it's coming. So don't worry. Tend to your life now, and tend to those around you. And tending to your life now means living by faith in our chief shepherd, Jesus Christ. This means living now for the future without tears and hardships. And we must rear our lives now for this future. Christ, our shepherd, is our example for living life now. This means that we must be shepherds of our own lives regardless of our age. This means that in our lives, we must both tend and rear. With Pentecost approaching, we focus on God's Spirit, this incredible gift. This gift is described in the Bible as a helper. Ask God for more of his Spirit to help tend our lives now, but also to help rear our lives for that glorious future to come. Happy Sabbath, brethren.